This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's a familiar scenario seen almost every night on TV. A ghastly crime has been committed. A smartly dressed man or woman walks grim-faced into the crime scene, picks up an ostensibly irrelevant object, a snow globe or a fountain pen, maybe. Turning it around in his hands, the profiler says, "Our killer is a 35-year-old man with a limp." Cue the local cops who now know who to look for. TV shows like Criminal Minds and movies like The Silence of the Lambs not only celebrate the criminal profiler, they've established the profile as a legitimate, at times almost magical, tool for investigators. In the current issue of The New Yorker magazine, Malcolm Gladwell profiles the profilers and concludes that their act consists largely of smoke and mirrors. Malcolm Gladwell will be with us in just a moment. A bit later, we'll meet former FBI profiler John Douglas. You will not be surprised to hear that he disagrees with Mr. Gladwell's analysis. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Senator Charles Grassley, who's announced an investigation into the finances of six so-called mega-ministries, plus the new vigilante cell phone jammers. But first, criminal profiling. If you have an experience with profiling or questions about how profiles are created, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Malcolm Gladwell is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His article, Dangerous Minds, Criminal Profiling Made Easy, appears in this week's issue of the magazine. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program again, Malcolm.
Thank you, Neil.
And you describe this investigative tool. Well, in this sense, crimes aren't whodunits that we've become familiar with, but you describe them as he-dunits.
Yes, because the profilers seem to dispense with the ordinary normal process of investigation and try and decide just on the basis of what they see in a crime scene who the police ought to be looking for. And I think the process and the procedures they use to reach those conclusions are not entirely legitimate.
Mm-hmm. For example?
Well, the whole topology that the FBI has used arises out of a series of interviews done in the 1980s with serial killers around the country. The number was 33. And John Douglas was one of those who conducted those interviews. And on the basis of those interviews, they decided that they could put all serial killers into one of two camps, the organized camp and the disorganized camp. Later, they decided there was a third camp, which was for those who were neither organized or disorganized, but that, which sort of gives you some flavor for just how effective this topology is. But they decided you belong to one of those two camps, and they made that decision based on what they observed in the crime scene. If it looked like there wasn't a lot of forethought, then they said you were disorganized. If it looked like you had planned it out, they said you were organized. And from those two distinctions, they then drew a whole series of other conclusions about who you were and what you were like. Mm-hmm. And that's where all of this, the kind of detail you see in these television shows, comes from that fact. So if you're, you know, disorganized, they'll say you're disheveled, you masturbate a lot, you read pornography. You know, and if you're organized, they say that you're above average intelligence. You know, you drive a police-like vehicle. And the point about all of these conclusions is that they're either so vague as to be useless or they're also based on assumptions that just don't hold up to scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Generally, though, aren't these profilers called in when there's an absence of other evidence and there's cops are floundering? They don't know which way to go.
Yeah, there is a kind of a natural tendency for local police officers to look for help from experts when it comes to tackling difficult crimes, and that's an appropriate role for the FBI. The harder question is when those experts from the FBI step in, do they help or hurt, or are they in any way useful? And there is an extraordinary dearth of hard evidence to show that the profiles created by the FBI are actually useful in catching criminals.
A dearth, they don't help?
Well, there was a large study done in England a couple of years ago by the commissioned by the British Home Office, which discovered that in 2.7% of cases, police officers said the profile actually led to the arrest of a suspect. 2.7%. A stopped clock is more useful than that.
Were they analyzing American cases that involved the FBI or British cases that involved MI6?
They were involving a database of British cases. But the principles on which these profilers work are fairly similar. So mm-hmm. I think it's a – we have an FBI study, which I'm sure John Douglas will talk about when he comes on, which uses a much softer standard, which said when does it help in the arrest of a suspect. And they're the best number they could come up with, I think, was 16%. These are not impressive numbers. And they're also highly subjective. You know, if you're asking police, does something help – you're going to get a larger number than if you ask a very strict question like, did it actually lead to the arrest of a suspect?
And are you critical of the entire concept of profiling, or would you suggest that there might be better ways to profile?
No, I think that there is absolutely a role for forensic investigation and analysis in investigations of crimes. And there are no question that there are people out there who can be of enormous value to law enforcement based on a kind of proper scientific evaluation of the evidence in a crime. All I'm saying is that the particular kind of profiling that the FBI fell in love with in the 80s, and that is represented in the books written by people like John Douglas and in the television shows that have been inspired by them, there is not sufficient evidence to suggest that that kind of profiling is useful.
Well, let's hear from Mr. Douglas. John Douglas is a former FBI agent, one of the pioneers in the field of criminal profiling. He's the author of Mindhunter and most recently Inside the Mind of the BTK Killer, which came out last month. He's been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. John Douglas, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Well, thank you. I began the research program back in the very early 80s. As a result of being transferred to the FBI Academy, I was the youngest instructor at the FBI Academy. And Mr. Gladwell mentioned that Howard Teton was my mentor, and mm-hmm. Dr. James Brussel, he was a mentor to Teton. That's totally false. The reason I decided to conduct the research was to accelerate my learning. And what better way was than to go out and really interview the experts relative to to the crime? If I was interested in finding out who was successful in business, I would want to ask successful business persons the same types of questions. So we developed a computerized instrument with 57 pages, thousands of questions concerning the victim, concerning pre-offense behavior on the part of the subject, post-offense behavior on the part of the subject. We analyzed the forensic evidence that was furnished to us, the toxicology reports, the forensic pathology reports, looking for patterns and trends. We took ourselves away from behavioral science because when we were looking at behavioral science to help us, their own categories were very, very confusing. I interviewed Charles Manson. When I interviewed Manson, mm-hmm. Someone referred to him as a paranoid schizophrenic. Someone else applied the category of being a psychopathic personality. What does that mean to law enforcement? So I decided, along with my colleagues, and it was myself and Roy Hazelwood. It wasn't Ressler, you indicated. We decided to describe the crime scenes that law enforcement would understand. But it is not A or B. You don't say, Susan, we got a case from Topeka, send out the disorganized profile. Or we got one from New Rochelle, send out the other profile on the disorganized. It's a continuum. And we even came up with a mixed category. And in a lot of cases, I was brought in on the O.J. Simpson case, in the civil case. That case starts off organized. It starts off organized. The subject brought a knife to the scene, wore a PCAP that was left during the initial assault of Nicole and Ron Goldman. But then things began to deteriorate. So you have the components of disorganized and organized. The disorganized, what happened was he lost control. He lost control because of Goldman put up one heck of a fight mm-hmm. there. And what I also did was to classify that crime as a personal cause homicide. I don't know if he's referring to the manual. I'm not sure he knows or not, but it is a crime classification manual, and it's the work and the input of thousands of police all over the world relative to homicide, a variety of homicide cases. We just don't do serial murder cases, a variety of cases, mm-hmm. arson, bombings, child molestation.
And how often are profiles responsible for the arrest of the person responsible or providing crucial information toward that arrest?
We did a study back in the 80s, but it was a consumer report, but not so much. It included the profile, but was it beneficial, what we're providing? We're not soliciting cases. This is domestic police cooperation. The police are coming to us.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, in many of the cases, we cannot provide a profile. So what are you going to do? You may provide interview interrogation techniques. We may be able to provide proactive techniques regarding developing a technique to catch the offender. We may talk to a prosecutor or a defense attorney to have them better understand what
the
case
is about.
So
you may help in a lot of ways. How often do profiles in and of themselves help solve crimes?
I don't know the percentage that he came up with. When the study, as far as the overall, it was all the services, was about 80%. But it's not going to be – the profile is not going to be that successful at an 80% percentile. But it helps narrow – what you're trying to do is narrow or focus or refocus the investigation. And when the police come to you, they pretty much have exhausted all leads. There's no place for them to turn.
So they've analyzed all the fingerprints and looked at all the blood spatter, whatever it may be. The physical evidence is not leading them anywhere. They're going to you. It used to be you when you were at the FBI.
Right, but I still do. I do cases pro bono for police, for victims of violent crime, and I had cases coming from New York, and like an arson case, and I'll do an arson analysis, but the profile would fit so many people in that area, and I'll tell them, I can't help you.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help you. I may be able to help you when you come up with a suspect, provide you interview techniques. I may be able to help you draw in the guy, develop some kind of proactive technique. We can set him up and maybe cause him to inject himself into the investigation. So in most cases, and when I left the Bureau in 1995, when I retired, most of my work then was really developing creative, proactive techniques and providing police pre-offense behavioral characteristics and post-offense behavioral characteristics, because I was afraid by providing a list of characteristics, you could have missed. This is imperfect. This is not science, and, mm-hmm. and I agree with them. It's not science, and it is as good as a person that's doing it. What bothers me is every time there's a major case in the United States, it's like Groundhog Day. The same guys and women pop up on television and are the so-called experts, and they are not experts in the field.
I'm talking about who might have, on the basis of whatever thin right. evidence they may have been presented with, might have done the crime. More with Malcolm Gladwell and with John Douglas about profilers and your calls. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Senator Chuck Grassley joins us a little bit later to talk about the investigation he's leading into several well-known evangelists and the money they raise. That's coming up later this hour. Right now, we're talking about profiling the profilers. Just before the break, you heard two distinctive views. Malcolm Gladwell, a staff writer at The New Yorker, who's written an article called Dangerous Minds in this week's issue of the magazine, and John Douglas, former FBI agent and one of the first criminal profilers. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also send us your comments at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And we want to get to listeners' questions, but Malcolm Gladwell, just before we went away, John Douglas issued a response to it sounds like you people are describing two completely different things.
Well, I was I don't think so. I was struck by something that Mr. Douglas said. He said this is not science, and my question is, why isn't it science? Shouldn't it be science? Psychology is science in a sense that we attempt to draw conclusions that are supported by the evidence, and we ought to be able to impose that same rigor on something as critical as criminal profiling.
Why?
And one of the things that I do in my piece is to spend a lot of time talking about the research of a group of psychologists in England at the University of Liverpool
mm-hmm.
who have tried to do exactly that, who have tried to rigorously take a step backwards and examine the assumptions upon which the FBI's profiling systems are based. And when they do that, they find no evidence whatsoever to support their claims. Let me give you a very quick example. One of the principal assumptions of profiling is that you ought to be able to extract from a crime scene certain conclusions about the criminal. That is to say that the actions that are represented in the crime scene will tell you something reliable about certain characteristics of the criminal. That's called a homology assumption. Now, is homology something that is scientifically valid? That is to say, when we look at at crime scenes. Is there, are there patterns about the offender that can be reliably extracted from it? When the British group tried to verify that homology assumption, they found nothing. They found that there is no pattern, that you cannot draw an assumption from behavior that helps you reliably predict something about the person doing the performing the crime. Now, that strikes me as a pretty devastating blow to the idea of profiling. And it strikes me that if I were a profiler, I would have to deal with that scientific objection to what I'm doing before I went back out into the field and gave quote-unquote advice to local law enforcement.
And John Douglas, and then we'll get to the calls, I promise. Is it science if is Malcolm Gladwell right about homology?
We conducted interviews of 36 serial killers to begin with, but we've interviewed really dozens, hundreds more, and other types of violent offenders. I do not believe that we can have a statistical database that we could look at a case and say, okay, based on this case, 90% of the time it's going to be someone with a high school education. The same question was asked to me by a former Attorney General, Janet Reno, after Waco, Texas, and she wanted us to look at every possible type of hostage situation, barricaded subject. Mm-hmm. And on the break, I went up to her and I said, we are doing interviews and we are conducting the research. However, what if it was a situation where we had a barricaded subject and I told you that 90% of the time, if we did X, Y, and Z from previous cases, we had a favorable response. But in this particular case, I don't believe this. We should go with the 90%. It's the 10%. We should go with the 10%. What would you do? Attorney General Reno told me, he says, well, I would weigh everything and I'll make my decision. But technically, I know what would happen politically. She would pick the 90% because if something went wrong, she could always say, well, I went with the statistics. Every case is analyzed individually. It's not an A, B, C, D type of checklist. And some people try to make it that way.
I'm not hearing an answer to the question. You've said it's not science, and we've heard your explanation of that. Does what Malcolm Gladwell describes as homology. Can you go to a crime scene and reliably extract something useful about who did it?
Yes. Yes. I did a case recently based on the analysis of the scene. The woman was taken from inside the house. She was strangled. She was placed under the crawl space of the house. After analyzing the case, there was a lot of different things going on with the case. I said that the person responsible here is a domestic homicide. Well, why is that? Well, what would be the reasoning to remove the victim from upstairs on the second floor to hide it into the crawl space? And I said the reason is that he killed his wife and he took his child out later that day. And when he came back, he did not want his son to find his wife killed upstairs. So I said the crime scene has been staged. And he took that and ran with that, and the husband was responsible. Mm.
Let's at long last get some listeners involved in the conversation. I apologize. 800-989-8255. And let's start with Stephanie. Stephanie with us from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
Really, really interesting show. Here's my question. I'm going to ask my question and then I'm going to hang up and listen off the
on the radio.
Right. Anyway, I'm wondering if perhaps profiling could actually be a hindrance to investigations because it might narrow the investigation too much. People would be focusing so much on the profiles that they would miss things that otherwise might come out at them, or maybe miss an atypical situation. And I would love it also if you could really, I understand about the interviews, and I'm wondering if maybe part of the profiling is some kind of detail or factor analysis, but also describe what goes into creating a profile. And I'm going to hang up, and thank you so much.
Okay. Why don't you answer that last part of the question, if you would, John Douglas.
The factors that go into the profile. The factors go into the profile is a detailed victimology regarding the specifics of the victim. We categorize the victim high risk, low risk. The forensics is extremely critical. A case I just came back from in West Memphis, Arkansas, we had a pathologist say that the crime was that of a satanic murder. It turns out the boy was emasculated. It turns out it was an alligator snapping turtle responsible for that. Mm-hmm. We're only as good as the information received. We also we rely on police investigation, the preliminary police reports, all the forensic evidence, and with the hope of directing, focusing the investigation, or refocusing the investigation, and hopefully we'll be sending them in the right direction. But what has to be understood by the listeners is that this is used. Criminal profiling is used after all logical leads have been exhausted. They come to us with their hands up. We don't know, or we may have a suspect. We don't know if this person is a person we believe who's responsible.
Mm-hmm. And Malcolm Gladwell, were you able to find evidence of instances where profiling actually got in the way of successfully solving a crime?
Well, I think you could make a very strong argument that in the search for the Unabomber, the profiles, they were Mr. Douglas knows this history well. They were warring profiles within the FBI, one of which said that the Unabomber was a kind of blue-collar guy, one of which said that the Unabomber was an educated guy, with ties to academia. And no one could decide which one was right and which one was to follow. And finally, for a critical period, the blue-collar, the completely wrong profile, was the one that was guiding the investigation. Secondarily as well, the profiles in that case consistently said that the offender was younger than he actually was, which proved absolutely critical because many times they came close to identifying Kaczynski as a suspect, but didn't because they were looking for someone who was younger. So I think this is absolutely a kind of occupational hazard of this kind of astrological exercise. And that is, to the extent that you provide more specific details and try to be more useful to the investigation, you also run a very high false positive risk. Mm-hmm. The risk of giving information that completely throws that inappropriately narrows the focus of the investigation. And that, to me, we have to think about not just those cases. I mean, profilers do wonderful jobs telling us about the cases when they were right, and very little time telling us about the times when they were wrong. And we need to sit down and figure out, does the bad stuff outweigh the value of the good stuff? And I think it does.
Mm-hmm. John Douglas, does the bad stuff outweigh the value of the good?
No. In fact, in my books that he's talking about, including this book, Inside the Mind of the BTK, I put in parts of the analysis that was done that was wrong. I mean, we thought the subject would not be married. We thought he'd be single. Getting back to the Unabomber, I have to agree with him. There was a problem with the Unabomber case. I did the original profile in the early 80s, and it evolved and evolved. And by the time, just before his arrest, it was a group of us in the behavioral science unit who believed we were dealing with an academic individual, an older individual. I don't know what he's talking about here, because the case went on for 20 years. It was an older individual we were looking for, but there were people in the other side in the FBI who, because of evidence found at the first bombing, the Unabomber, there was a material found, steel wool, that was only used by airplane mechanics. So they stayed with this red herring, that forensic evidence. Even when we had the manifesto, and you can tell this was a professor. This person was bright. He turned out to be bright. He had 155 IQ. So there were factions within the organization. And just like there are factions, not all of us will think the same when we're analyzing a case. We may have disagreements. I've gone against the Bureau on several cases. JonBenet Ramsey. I took a totally different side on that case than the FBI.
Yet, in this sort of situation, I think one of the things that Malcolm Gladwell writes about, or he can speak for himself, but it's this idea that there's this sort of magical tool that can be unloaded off a plane when the FBI profilers come to town. And I think what he's suggesting is this. Well, he's not more than suggesting this may do more harm than it does good.
Well, this is the story by the media and the shows that are on television. Again, when we brought in, we're not asked to go into the case. We're invited to go into the case. And if we don't know, when we had the D.C. bombing case here, I did not do a single interview. And there were all these talking heads who were coming up saying it was going to be a white male. When he was finally...
You mean the D.C. sniper?
The D.C. sniper. When he was finally arrested, I then did all these different shows. And they showed all these different so-called profilers. Mm-hmm. It's a guy from out of town with a briefcase, basically, is the expert. And they were the guy from out of town. They said, John, how come you didn't talk to us? How come you didn't go on our shows? You know why I didn't go on your shows? Because I didn't know, and I didn't want to jeopardize the investigation. These other people were actually jeopardizing the police investigation and getting in the way, getting in the way of police. And I did know from research in the past that these offenders follow the press. And I could see just from reading and watching, he was responding to what was being said by these profilers. And then he went down where I live, down in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He ended up killing two people down there when these people were saying, well, he's going to start moving now further south.
Can I just point out one thing?
Go ahead, Malcolm Gladwell.
When Mr. Douglas talks about how the media has this notion of false notion of profilers, the reason the media has this false notion of profilers is because Mr. Douglas wrote books like Mindhunter and Obsession and his new one, Inside the Mind of BTK. I mean, it's awfully rich for him to turn around and start blaming the media for having a false notion of what profilers do when he created that notion in those books. I mean, if he wrote his books, which I have read, in the same way that he's talking now, we wouldn't have this problem. But the truth is, if you read those books, they give a very clear picture of the profiler as this magician, this person, this seer, this one who has special insight and can bring clarity where there is only, you know, vagueness and cloudiness and darkness. And that's nonsense. There's just no evidence for it. Hmm. And it's you know, I think Mr. Douglas has to acknowledge that this, if there is a phony notion out there about profilers, it is there because he helped create it.
We're talking with Malcolm Gladwell of The New Yorker magazine and with former FBI profiler John Douglas. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm going to give you a brief chance to respond, John Douglas. Then we're going to get to another call, I promise.
Okay. I really don't believe he read the books, because if he read the books that I published, he has inaccuracies in his report to the New Yorker. He mentions this Bronx, New York case, which may have to wait for a break. But he leaves out specific details in that in that case, and making it sound like, oh, look at me now. I can sit back here. It's going to be a white male in this age group, and on and on and on. His information was totally wrong. And I did not have my first book was a bestseller, Mindhunter. The second was Journey to Darkness. It wasn't an obsession like you wrote in your article. So you got that part wrong too.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is going to be Kurt. Kurt with us from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead, please.
I had a question for Mr. Douglas. Out here in Buffalo, we just finally closed the book on a real old case that we call the Bike Path Rapist. Are you familiar with it at all?
Just briefly, not really. I don't have the specifics, no.
Well, anyways, this guy, Al Sanchez, was apprehended by police about a year ago, and this summer he pled guilty to all the crimes, and there was a lot of questions in the Western New York community about why it took so long to find him. And he kind of disappeared for a while. I believe he took something like 9 years off.
Between crimes?
What's that?
Between the crimes, you mean?
Yeah. A bunch of them were back to back to back, and then he kind of disappeared. They never found him, but people, I guess...
I don't mean to hurry you up, Kurt, but is there your question, if you would?
What do you do? I mean, if when a guy goes off the map like that, do you start over from scratch? Do you stick by an old profile? And if you're at all familiar with it, to what extent did the profile fit?
Mm-hmm.
And if it did fit, why? You know, at the risk of sounding critical, and I'm not at all, because he was caught. Why did it take so long?
That's a frustration that I think a lot of people have with a lot of cases.
Well, he stopped. Sometimes they stop because the police came real close to them in the investigation. They stop because they're always pretty much predatory, looking for victims of opportunity. Sometimes they get scared. In the case of the BTK strangler, he got caught by his wife in bondage. She came home early one day. Right after he killed the victim, he had the victim's dress on. He had a ligature around his neck. He was in full bondage and looking at himself in a mirror. And his wife caught him and just scared the dickens out of him. And that stopped him for a couple of years. And then until later on, he resurfaced again. But the case in Rochester, which is a great case, was Arthur Shawcross case that your call should be familiar with. And one of the things we said was, if you you find a victim, stake out the body, because the tendency of the killer, it would be returned to the scene. And lo and behold, the New York State Police went up in their choppers, scouting around, and here they found in a frozen body of water underneath the bridge was a body. And up on top of the bridge at the time sitting was a male individual eating a sandwich. They landed, came after the subject, turned out to be Arthur Shawcross, a serial killer who just got out of jail a few years earlier for killing two children, and they paroled him. So it helped in that area.
Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell, we're going to give you the last word since you wrote the piece that inspired this conversation. Mm-hmm. You still think it's smoke and mirrors?
I do. I think it's astrology. The larger question here is human behavior, particularly the human behavior of these kinds of people, sufficiently predictable that we can generate rules and assumptions that allow us to create profiles? And if you examine closely, as this group in England I've talked about, if you examine closely a large number of these kind of difficult serial killer cases, what you find is their behavior is not sufficiently predictable to allow for those kinds of assumptions. And that's the core issue. And to pretend that there is predictability where there is not is illegitimate. And it leads to mistakes, and it misleads the kinds of people who have to do the hard work of catching criminals.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But thanks to our guests very much for their time. You just heard Malcolm Gladwell, a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of the books Blink and The Tipping Point. You can find a link to his article, Dangerous Minds, on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Our thanks, too, to John Douglas, the former FBI agent and one of the pioneers in the criminal profiling field. His latest book, Inside the Mind of the BTK Killer. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
When we come back, Charles Grassley on megachurches. This is NPR News.